From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Sometimes the emotional power of a story defies an introduction. This is one such story. It comes to us from Kemp Powers, who tells it in a memoir called The Shooting. Kemp Powers sat down with Anne Strainchamps.
The rough outline of what happened is, well, you stated in one sentence at the beginning of your book, when I was 14, I shot my best friend in the face and watched him die. What actually happened?
We were all kind of, I guess the word was, gun enthusiasts as kids, as most kids in Brooklyn were at that time. My mom was actually in the Army Reserve, so she had several firearms in the house. And we would always toy around with them when she wasn't home, and she never really knew this. So one day, two friends of mine came over, and we were playing around with the guns, and I was doing what I thought was a fake game of Russian roulette. And I didn't realize a bullet was in the chamber, and pulled the trigger, pointed at one of my friends, and it went off, and it hit him right in the face. And when I say watched him die, I mean that's the best way to describe it, because I was feeling absolutely helpless and panicked. You know, I was just trying to figure out some way I could save him. And yeah, it was traumatic is an understatement for the moment.
What happened right after you shot him?
Well, he looked at me, and I mean, that's probably one of the images that's going to be, I guess, burned into my soul forever that I'll never forget, is just he, because when the gun went off, he turned. And I honestly didn't even think it hit him at first. So I was like, oh my goodness. And I said, are you okay? And when he turned back around, he had his hand over his mouth. So I still didn't know he was hit. And then he lowered his hand, and that's when I saw the bullet hole. And he was looking at me, like, shocked, and opened his mouth, and he just started exhaling blood.
Did he have time to say anything to you?
He couldn't speak. It was just gurgling sounds, and, you know, like, it sounded like he was trying to scream, but he couldn't get the sound out.
What did you do?
I mean, me and my friend both freaked out. The first thing I did was I ran to try to get some towels to stop the bleeding. So I, like, ran to the linen closet. And by the time I got back to the room, he was actually walking into the living room. So he had, like, taken a few steps. And I, you know, put the towels on his face. Then I figured, you know, I better go try to get some help. So I told my other friend who was there at the moment to, you know, hold the towels on his face. And I ran out into the hall, just banging on neighbors' doors. He fell over onto his face, like, right before I got out the door. And I don't know, it's just, I'm assuming it couldn't have been more than just a few minutes, but it seemed like that moment took like an hour. I mean, I just was running from one neighbor's door to the next and banging on neighbor's door. I got to one neighbor's door, and it's a New York thing where you live in these apartment buildings and you never know the people who live around you. You could live next door to someone for 20 years and never know them, never know their name. But I finally got to one neighbor's door and knocked on the door, and he opened it up, and I guess I had blood all over my shirt. I was like, you gotta come help me, you know, my friend, he's been shot, please come help. And he just closed the door on me, which really freaked me out even more, like, no one's gonna help us out here. And I ran downstairs. I was headed down to the street, and the police were actually on their way up. So, you know, I dragged them upstairs and just were begging them to help my friend, and, you know, he died.
Part of what makes the tragedy so especially horrible is that you and Henry had been very close. I mean, You described him in the book as your best friend. What was he like?
I mean, he was like a really great kid. I mean, you have these images in your mind of, like, city kids being, you know, really reckless and getting into a lot of trouble, and he wasn't any of those things. He was literally like the voice of reason among our little group. He came from a very religious family. I never, ever heard him utter a curse word, which is unusual for our group because every third word that came out of our mouths was a curse, and he never cursed at all. You know, he was just the most loyal and, like, reliable friend that any of us had. So when he died, I mean, it affected a lot of people profoundly.
When you think of him now, and I know you've thought of him a lot over the years, has he stayed the same age in your mind, or has he kind of grown with you?
Yeah, that's part of what's kind of troubled me at times.
Why?
You know, I think about it, and I actually, this whole ordeal has really made me, you know, I think a lot about things like religion and faith, and I'm just trying to find my way in those areas. But, you know, I mentioned it in the book even. I just say, you know, one of the things that really haunted me was, like, the older I got, like, what do I say to this 14-year-old if I ever see him again? You know what I mean? Like, how can I make him understand?
So there's a part of you that feels like he didn't understand and you're still struggling to try to make sense of it for him?
Yeah, yeah.
How about you? Have you been able to make sense of it for yourself? Or
I mean,
it
shouldn't have happened. It just shouldn't have happened. There's no excuse to be made. I mean, that it should have never happened.
Now, did you ever have, over the years, family members say to you, well, it must have been God's will?
Well, it's not something my family ever talked about.
At all?
No, no.
That must have made it really hard on you.
It did. It made it very hard. I mean, I didn't know what people were thinking, but it was just, it was kind of like it became a taboo subject. I mean, just no one wanted to talk about it.
One of the most moving and remarkable things about what happened immediately after the shooting is that Henry's family showed this remarkable kind of grace. I mean, they completely forgave you.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering whether that actually made it harder.
It made it a lot harder. I mean, because it didn't seem right. It just seemed incomprehensible. Because if the tables had been turned and something had happened to me, I couldn't imagine my mom being that forgiving or anyone's family being that forgiving. And I just, it didn't add up in my own mind. It just didn't make any sense. You know, I had been preparing, I guess, in the days immediately after it happened for the reaction from everyone, you know, just this overwhelmingly negative reaction. And just, I was prepared to just deal with that. I'd kind of like come to terms with it almost like, oh my goodness, you know, this. And to have that happen, it just throws you for a loop, you know. It's like preparing for a punch and being hugged.
So you were waiting for punishment. You were waiting for that other shoe to drop, and then just nothing happened. His parents refused to press charges. You didn't go to jail. You didn't go to a juvenile facility. So you were left without any really formal way to atone. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. And I guess that's what I've been trying to do ever since. You know, that's a lot of what I write about, is how feeling like nothing is ever enough, eventually you just crack. My daughter, when she was about 18 months old, got very, very sick, and she almost died. And it really brought back a lot of memories about him. And it made me, for a long time, I was feeling like it was some kind of divine redemption. You know, I feel like his family lost a child, and, you know, now it was time for me to lose a child. And it made it very, very difficult for me to be left alone with my young daughter for a long time, because I was just concerned that something would happen if she were left alone with me. I was very, very uncomfortable.
This book is about something that happened to you that was so terrible that for 15 years you never even spoke about it. What was it that happened that made you want to break your silence?
You know, I don't know if I was even really ready, but I just felt like I had to do it. I mean, it's still something that I have a great deal of difficulty speaking about. It was a lot easier. It wasn't easy to write about, but it was easier to write about than it is to actually talk about, to discuss. But, you know, I just thought it was important that I get it out.
What was the hardest part to write?
I mean, the event itself, the shooting, was very, very difficult. It took me a long time to actually recount all the details of that. I mean, I remembered it very well, but it was just very difficult to sit down and write down the words and get that out. So, I mean, obviously that was by far the most difficult part.
There's a place in the book when you write that whoever you were before the shooting happened died along with Henry. Do you ever wonder who you would be if the shooting hadn't happened?
Yeah, I do, because I do believe that, like, I might have been a completely different person if that day had never occurred. And it's actually something that's a bit disturbing.
Yeah.
A lot of times, because, you know, we were city kids and we were honor students, but at the same time, you know, we liked making mischief here and there. And I can't help but wonder, like, I would have probably never left New York. I mean, that's almost a certainty. I was one of those city kids who, like, barely ever left the block, let alone thought of going anyplace else, which makes me feel like I probably would have never become a writer. I feel like I would have been a completely different person. And the thing that kind of is disturbing to me is I think I might have been a worse person.
Hmm. Yeah, that's scary. And that does take you into that, you know, those sort of questions about God's will, fate, things like mm-hmm. that. I mean, you said earlier this should never have happened. And yet, isn't that a bit like saying I shouldn't be who I am now?
Well, there you go. Now you have my my quandary.
Kemp Power's memoir is called The Shooting. Anne Strangechamp spoke with him. At age 14, Kemp Powers shot and killed his best friend. Why? I mean, in the big picture, why did that gun go off? Was it a random act of chance? God's will? Or was this, as Bob Dylan put it, a simple twist of fate? Stay with us this hour as we delve into the philosophy and the mathematics of fate. And we'll take a look at the opposite of fate with novelist Amy Tan.
I think the opposite of fate is what I learned my mother had all along, which was not just to believe in fate, but its opposite, which is hope. And in hope, all things are possible.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Heads. Heads.
Ever play the coin toss game? Simple. I toss heads. The coin up in the air. Heads, I win. Tails, you win.
Heads.
50-50 chance.
Heads.
We're listening to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern playing the coin toss game. From Tom Stoppard
heads.
To Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. Problem for them is...
heads.
It keeps coming up heads. Over and over
heads.
And... over and over and over again. What are the chances of that?
Heads.
Well, Amir Azel has something to say about the odds of the coin toss game. He's written a book
heads.
Called Chance, a guide to gambling, love, the stock market, and
heads.
Just about everything else.
Heads.
Heads, I win.
Consider. One. Probability is a factor which operates within natural forces. Two. Probability is not operating as a factor. Three, we are now held within sub, or supernatural forces. Discuss.
Yes, it has very deep mathematical roots that have actually been probed in the 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century, something called measure theory in mathematics. It's a very complicated theory, and it allows us to understand the workings of chance at a certain level mathematically. So I have to say at a certain level because, well, chance is chance, but under certain circumstances, we can explain and measure probabilities to a very good degree.
Well, speaking of the mathematical basis of it then, can you give me an example of the way in which we can codify luck?
I can give you simple examples where, you know, if you roll a die 6,000 times, then 1,000 times, roughly, each one of the numbers will appear. So that's something that can be measured mathematically and proven as a limit theorem. And in the limit, as the number of rolls goes to infinity, exactly a sixth would be of each number. So in simple cases like that, luck can be very simply measured in mathematics.
Simple is fun, isn't it? As you say, with a single die, you know that statistically each number will appear 1 out of 6 times. But in fact, if you roll it 6 times, you don't know how many times 1 is going to appear.
Exactly, and in fact, it could appear six times in a row, and that happens. And, you know, we have events that are unlikely, and still they occur all the time. That's how people win lotteries and so on.
The funny thing is, we get runs where it doesn't occur, and it doesn't occur, and it doesn't occur, and it doesn't occur. And, you know, you think about the next one, and you think, you know, have the odds increased now? Because six times in a row, I didn't get a seven. Am I going to get it this time? Is it more likely? It isn't, is it?
No, this is one of the biggest paradoxes of the theory of probability, that we can work out things long term in the limit, but over a short range of trials, we really don't know what will happen. We only know the probabilities long term. As a mathematician, I have to tell you that if you watched three times a particular outcome, such as, I don't know, an even number occurring on roulette rather than odd, it doesn't mean that odd has a higher probability of coming up now, because all the trials are independent of each other, and that's a very key concept in probability theory. Everything is independent of everything else in games of chance. For example, if you roll a die and you roll it again, the two rolls are completely independent of each other. So on one hand, we say long term, as you roll the die for so many times, eventually it would be 1-6, 1-6, 1-6, and so on. But over a short range of trials, we can't say that because we really don't know what will happen. Having seen so many occurrences of one kind doesn't increase or decrease the probability of what will happen next.
Of course, all of us like the idea of there being a way to predict what's going to happen, that everything happens with a purpose, which always then leaves us hanging when something doesn't go according to plan. I mean, you're always saying, was that just coincidence that it worked that way?
Right. Murphy's Law, striking, but also Murphy's
right.
Law and also works the other way. Good occurrences in life happen perhaps as frequently overall as bad ones. You're doing better than expected, maybe as often, or certainly it does happen, as unexpectedly as bad things happening. In fact, you could view it as a normal curve as well, the center being what you expect, and then you have the tails to the left and to the right.
Yeah, of course, some of these mathematical equations, too, look very appealing, and then you use them and you realize that even though they're correct, it doesn't have any meaning. I mean, the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, you can find him, but who cares?
Right, yes. I have a chapter in the book on that, actually. That's one of the things that have always fascinated me about chance, is those coincidences that happen in life. You know, you meet somebody on an airplane and at random, not in the city. You haven't boarded together in the city where you live, for example, and you find out that by 1 degree of separation, meaning you both know a person in common, you know, you're separated by 1 degree of separation. That happens much more often than people expect, and I've computed that probability to about 1.5%, which is relatively high, I think.
Yeah, 1.5 times out of 100. That's amazing.
Right. So 1.5 times out of 100 times that you fly, you should have something in common with the person sitting next to you.
Now, the title of your book is A Guide is Chance, A Guide to Gambling, Love, the Stock Market, and Just About Everything Else. You've talked about gambling. What does love have to do with probability theory?
Oh, the reason I put that in is that there are nice examples where, you can think of meeting the person you would marry as a random event. So that's where chance controls love. I can imagine other ways as well.
Could you use the mathematical equation to figure out who you're going to meet and marry?
Well, the example I give in the book, the probability law that governs these things, is sort of interesting. It applies to other things as well. People have proved using fairly complex mathematics that, for example, if you could meet only 100 members of the opposite sex over your lifetime, if you go out with 37% of these people of the opposite sex, you should choose as your mate the next person that beats all 37, meaning that is more attractive to you than all the previous 37.
Well, that's common sense for you, isn't it?
Well, it's an optimality sort of rule that comes out from mathematics, that your chances of meeting the best out of the 100 is by sampling, so to speak, the first 37. It's really 1 over E is how you get that, the natural number E. That's a proportion of the total. So out of 100 would be 37, roughly 37%. And then you know what you're looking for, and then use the remaining ones to choose the best one. You pick the best one that is better than all 37, you stop right there. You marry her.
Of course, there are going to be a lot of people who are going to regret number 16 for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I think so.
Do you ever worry that knowing as much as you do about this has taken the fun out of life?
Yeah, what I try to tell myself is not to practice what I preach, perhaps. That leaves the fun in life, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Amir Azel. His book is called Chance, A Guide to Gambling, Love, the Stock Market, and just about everything else.
I'm on the ball again, riding for a fall again. I'm gonna give my all again, taking a chance. I'm taking a chance. I'm taking a chance on love.
It's Tony Bennett taking a chance on love. Now, statistically speaking, love's a much better bet than, oh, say, playing the lottery. You are 8,000 times more likely to get hit by lightning than to win the lottery. You're actually 16 times more likely to get killed driving to the gas station to buy a lottery ticket than you are to win it. But still, we play and dream of instant riches. Roy Kaplan says, maybe we're better off if we don't win the lottery. He's the author of the book called Lottery Winners, and he told Steve Paulson what happens to them.
Some people, it changes their lives and saves their lives. On the other hand, I've met a number of people said that they were sorry they won. And I find that difficult to believe because, you know, I never really met anybody that was willing to give the money back, you know. But the reality is there are all kinds of unintended and unanticipated consequences to winning.
Now, these are people who won huge jackpots. I mean, we're talking many millions of dollars here.
Well, in some cases, the reality is, though, it doesn't matter really how much you win. In many cases, you're still going to get bombarded from friends and relatives expecting that you're going to help them out in some way or another. They don't just expect it. They're anticipating a check in the mail.
Now, one thing that you often hear about is that even after people win one of these big jackpots, they'll often say they want to keep their job. And I guess they often do keep it for a few months, but it doesn't seem to last after that.
I found many people who were anxious to continue their work. And in a way, that was very positive because they recognized that work is something that ties you into a community. You have your friends at work or acquaintances, and it gives you something meaningful to do with your time, your mind, or your hands. And there were many instances where people kept working and then they were resented by coworkers. What are you doing? You're taking the job away from somebody who really needs it. You don't need the money anymore. That is one of the things. Another thing that people sometimes don't understand is the notoriety that attends to winning money or anything. And this brings, in some cases, unwanted attention from individuals who are sometimes con artists or, you know, I can recall one woman who tried to keep it a total secret from her neighbors, which is almost impossible these days. But she moved and didn't think that anybody around there knew her and was shopping in a supermarket. And an old friend of hers from where she used to live ran into her and just in front of everybody said, oh, there's the millionaire. How are you doing these days? Right in front of everybody. Another case I remember, and this fellow was almost paranoid. I can recall knocking on his door. I used to show up unannounced. I won't give all my techniques of getting these interviews, but I would show up unannounced, and I knocked on his door, and he said, looked at me stony-faced. He said, nobody won the lottery here. I didn't know what to say. I said, what are you talking about? How did you get on my list? He said, I don't know what you're talking about. And I guess I looked so upset, you know, and that he said, well, come on in, he said, but I'll deny it to everybody. And then his wife was upstairs, and she took one look down and just went back upstairs. He said she won't talk to anybody about it. And we have taught our children how to respond when people say, where's your dad or something, because the neighbors didn't know either. And he said sometimes they suspect things and they try to trip the kids up, but we gave them stories that they could give about how I don't have to work anymore because of, you know, some other circumstances. And
so they had to construct a whole fake life. I mean, it's sort of astonishing. I mean, they have to turn their lives inside out to present themselves to the world to be acceptable. I mean, it's kind of astonishing.
Oh, yes. And I mean, I can tell you that I found it rather tragic because here they realize the American dream of sudden riches, you know, and they were somewhat reluctant to live that lifestyle that they thought would bring this joy to them.
Isn't there a difference, though, between getting, $500,000 and getting $100 million? I mean, basically, it means you never have to worry about money again, presumably.
You're wrong, because I found them, and they were broke.
They were broke?
I met many people who spent their annual installments even prior to getting it. In some ways, you know, it's good that these things are paid annually rather than in a lump sum. But routinely, people were spending the annual installments and then borrowing against future ones. And so, I mean, that wasn't good. But imagine what would happen if you gave them a lump sum and, all at once, that would probably catapult them into a life of a lot of misery in some cases.
Does the idea of fate have any special meaning for you after having studied all of this?
I've interviewed people who've won more than once, sometimes more than twice or three times. I know that there's, and I'll tell your listeners, there's no technique, there's no method for winning the money. I've interviewed many people who only bought one ticket and never played again. And I've met people who spent hundreds and hundreds of dollars every week and won. So save your money. I know I'm not the greatest ad for the lotteries, but it's all random. There's no system. I don't care whether they say they're computerized. I know people that have developed those systems, and they're no better than if you just threw a dart at a chart and picked a number, because there's no way that you can systematically beat the lottery.
Roy Kaplan's book is called Lottery Winners: How They Won and How Winning Changed Their Lives. This hour, we're talking about fate and chance. And a show on fate and chance would not be complete without a discussion of Kevin Bacon. Or more correctly, the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. It's the game we all know and love, where you connect your favorite actor to Kevin Bacon in 6 steps or less. Steve Paulson sat down with one of the inventors of the game, Brian Turtle, to play the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Okay, give me an example of this. Let's say, I don't know, Marlon Brando.
All right, well, Marlon Brando was in The Godfather with Al Pacino. Al Pacino was in Sea of Love with Ellen Barkin. Ellen Barkin was in Diner with Kevin Bacon.
Okay, Robert De Niro.
Robert De Niro was in Sleepers with Kevin Bacon.
Wow, you really have these things at your fingertips, don't you?
You know what? It's actually funny you should say that, because there was a time where I would rattle them off. It was like shooting ducks in a pond, but I've gotten a little bit rusty, so hopefully you won't stump me.
Now, you and your friends invented this game. How did that happen?
Actually, it was due to one of these severe weather storms. I think it was 1993. We were attending Albright College in Reading, Pennsylvania, and pretty much snowed in for a good solid week during the month of January there. So we did what any normal college kid would do and, you know, got a few cases of beer and turned on the TV. And it kind of spawned out of too much time spent being a couch potato. Just a lot of weekday afternoon movies. And what happened was we found ourselves watching Footloose one day, and the next day here was Quicksilver on TV, and then a commercial for another Kevin Bacon movie came on, and it was like, yo, this guy's everywhere. What's going on here?
Kevin Bacon really is the center of the entertainment universe.
Exactly. You know, it was one of these things where the collective light bulb went off, and I guess the way it sort of snowballed is that we actually did something about it. You know, it wasn't just a funny conversation that lasted 15 minutes and we moved on. I mean, we really dwelled on this thing almost to a scary level.
Now, your game is called 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. 6 degrees meaning, you know, you've got to make these connections within 6 links. How did you come
exactly
up with that number?
To be honest with you, I can't even take full credit for naming it the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, nor can my two partners in the game, Mike Ginelli and Craig Fass. What happened was, after we started playing the game amongst ourselves or playing it on campus, we realized, you know what, there's a real hook here. This kind of works. We just called it Back to Bacon, or, you know, getting back to bacon, connecting it to bacon. There was no real name to it. And we wound up going on the Jon Stewart Show. This is, again, back in 1993, before The Daily Show and before really, I guess he was at the height of his popularity. So he would take on an obscure guest like us. And one of his producers says, you know, wow, this is really a lot like the 6 degrees of separation. And she's like, wait a second, it's the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. And from there, it just grew a whole nother level, and it really, it had a name for itself.
Now, how did you ever get on the Jon Stewart show? I mean, here you were just three college kids, you know, with this wacky idea. Why did Jon Stewart ever decide to take you on?
Beats me. I mean, it was one of these things where, again, having watched all the TV and everything, of course, we flip over to MTV, and then there's the Jon Stewart show. And he had on a roller skating chicken the one afternoon as we watched the show. And we said, geez, you know, this is really mindless. Kind of like our little Kevin Bacon game. Maybe there's an audience for this. Maybe this could grow bigger than just little old Albright College here in Reading, PA. So we literally dialed, you know, 555-1212, called information, got New York City, got MTV. We called, we said we wanted to speak to somebody at the Jon Stewart show. They said, sure, and we get right through. I mean, it was unbelievable how easy it was. Then we said we wanted to come on the show. So, of course, they think, well, we want tickets for the studio audience. We said, no, we want to be on the show. We think we have something that can wow you. So they said, well, you have to submit it in writing. We wrote this off-the-wall letter that didn't exactly say what it was that the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon was at that time. It really more or less just said that we were obsessed with Kevin Bacon and he was the center of the universe and we had to prove this to the world.
This must have been a very persuasive letter that you wrote.
I'll tell you what. It was written in that colorful college language that really doesn't make any sense, but leaves you curious to figure out what it all really means.
Do you remember what you wrote?
One piece of it was, you know, we are three men on a mission set out to prove to the world that Bacon is God. And, you know, just really off-the-wall stuff in the letter that, you know, we made references to Gary Coleman and, you know, the Shaolin monks. And it was none of it was really connected unless you knew what we were talking about. And it did pique their curiosity, thank goodness. And so we got a phone call from the talent agent of the Jon Stewart show. And so, of course, we asked him to throw us out an actor or an actress, and we, bam, connected it to Kevin Bacon. Then all of a sudden, he throws another one, bam, back to Bacon. He gets us on speakerphone in his end, and before we know it, we have 15 people in his office all shouting names at us.
All trying to stump you.
Exactly, and we were just drilling them. We were really in fighting shape at that point. And so, you know, eventually the phone call ended, and he just said, look, we got to get you guys on the show. That was sort of the first obstacle. Not that really we had ever set out to even do anything.
And, you know, the irony is I'm betting that a lot of people actually are more familiar with the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon than any particular movie roles that Kevin Bacon has been in.
It could be. I mean, it did really kind of take on a life of its own over a number of years there, the game that is. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there were more people out there who knew or had heard of the game or even have played a round or two of the game than, you know, would know, you know, 6 or 7 Kevin Bacon movies.
Now, can you get pretty obscure? I mean, suppose Kit, the car in the Knight Rider. Can you do
that? Well, sure, because you could do it with Kit was, you know, an inanimate object, but it was a character. That character was with David Hasselhoff, who was Michael Knight, of course. David Hasselhoff then went on to Baywatch fame and fortune with Pam Anderson. Pam Anderson was in Barbed Wire, great movie that was, with Michael Ironsides, who was in Top Gun with Tom Cruise, who was in A Few Good Men with Kevin Bacon.
There you go.
There you go. Kick the car to Kevin Bacon.
Yes. Now, I read somewhere that there's actually some mathematical theory behind the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
There is. And it's the new science of networks, and they use the Kevin Bacon model as just another reinforcement for the 6 degrees of separation. But then they really put the magnifying glass on the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, and they start to do the math, and they would just say, okay, well, if Demi Moore's been in 30 movies, what's the logarithm here that will make her Bacon number an average of 2.4? I mean, there's an equation there which says based on the number of movies you were in and maybe the quality or the A-list talent that you had worked with, there's a way to figure it out how you would be connected to Kevin Bacon without actually even doing the connections. But me, I'm old-fashioned. I prefer to use the old connecting route myself and leave the calculator at home. But, you know, the most connected person, according to the whole mathematics behind it, is Rod Steiger.
You know, when you think about it, the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon has really become part of our culture. I mean, I think just about everyone has heard this phrase. It's kind of scary, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's crazy when you flip on a TV and Kevin Bacon's on an episode of Will and Grace and they reference the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, or a whole category of Jeopardy is the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. I mean, it's just kind of seeped into the culture, and it just every so often will rear its head and remind you that it's still there and still very alive out there. So,
okay, can you do one last one for me? Elvis.
Elvis was in Clam Bake with Bill Bixby, who, of course, was the original Incredible Hulk. Bill Bixby was in Kentucky Fried Movie with Donald Sutherland. Donald Sutherland was in Animal House with Kevin Bacon. Okay.
There
a lot
you
of
go.
People forget Kevin Bacon was in Animal House, but he was.
He didn't have much of a role in that, did he?
No, but he did have a classic line of, "Thank you, sir, may I have another?" He was the guy getting paddled in Animal House. Go back and watch it. It's something that a lot of people forget, but it was his first movie role was in Animal House.
Thank you, sir, may I have another?
There you go. Kevin Bacon's only line in Animal House. Brian Turtle is one of the inventors of the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. He's also the co-author of the best-selling book with the same title. And, of course, the co-designer of the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon board game. Now, if you're like me, you must be wondering by now what Kevin Bacon thinks of all this. Well, here's Kevin Bacon from an old Fox morning show.
Kevin, how do you feel? I noticed you wrote the foreword for the book, so I guess you're not too steamed with these guys.
No, you know, I've grown to love these guys.
Thank you.
Crying.
No. Is that how you always felt?
Well, you know, at first I was a little. At first I sort of thought it was a joke, you know, at my expense.
No, no.
Sort of like, you know, can you believe this loser can be linked to everybody?
No,
you know, and then, but that's kind of like, you know, I think, you know, that everybody will understand that's sort of like the actor's, you know, insecurity. You know, you immediately think, you know, you're the brunt of everyone's jokes. But eventually I realized that I was sort of warming to the idea when someone said that they could actually play the game with Arnold Schwarzenegger as well. And I was like, hey, wait a second. That's my game.
It's a world of laughter, a world of tears. It's a world of hopes and a world of fears. There's so much that we share that it's time we're aware. It's a small world after all. 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 It's a small, small world.
Coming up next, our discussion of fate and chance continues with novelist Amy Tan.
I don't know how you explain those things, but this is when I feel like there are these mysteries that happen, and they just make you smile, and you will never understand them, but there's good in them, and I like to believe there's good in the world that we just can't explain.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We get lots of email at ttbook.org. Greg Peniston writes, "I was listening to your show on metafiction and was pleased to hear some discussion of Cervantes. I just started reading Don Quixote with my 16-year-old daughter, and we've been delighted by the humor of the book and the fact that we can get it 500 years later. But after the preface reading, my daughter and I looked at each other blankly. I encourage your listeners who do not have the stomach for Old English to try reading the Walter Starkey translation. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. This hour, we've been discussing chance and fate. These are subjects that obsess novelist Amy Tan. In her new memoir, The Opposite of Fate,
She muses on the chance occurrences of her life. Amy Tan was on her way to China when Anne Strainchamps caught up with her to talk about fate and its opposite.
You know, I think kids growing up today in our largely secular Western culture must get the message that the main forces shaping their lives are nature and nurture and free will. I mean, we're very scientific about it. You know, you've got DNA, and then you've got your family issues, and then you've got
right.
the choices you make in your life. Did growing up in a Chinese family give you different ideas about the forces that shape our lives?
I had, I think, a much broader spectrum of things to choose from. For one thing, my mother believed in Chinese fate, which included something that was the equivalent of a divinity who decides for you certain aspects of your life. And on top of that, reincarnation, which may have been a sort of fate as well. My mother used to say, you know, she was convinced we had known each other in a past life and she must have treated me horribly because why else would I have come back to torment her so? And, you know, she believed in a little bit of ancestor worship because she was fearful that she had somehow offended her mother who had committed suicide when she was 9, and that when bad things happened to our family, that that might have been the cause. And my father, on the other hand, was very religious. He was, in fact, ordained as a Baptist minister. He was the sort of person who prayed before every meal, and by the time I was 12 years old, we went to church almost every day, you know, Bible study, choir practice, youth night. So that was my life until the age of 15 when my father and my older brother died, both of them of brain tumors, which then set my mother into motion, into wondering why had this happened? You know, was it God's will? Was it fate? Was it, you know, a curse on our family? Was it bad feng shui in the house? Was it ancestors who were angry? And because she asked, why did this happen, she also went looking for all the possibilities to undo it.
You read, I think, you grew up believing in ghosts?
Well, you know, I had a lot of encouragement. My mother believed from the time I was about 4 years old that I had the ability to talk to ghosts. And that really was my...
Why did she think that?
Well, it was my fault because I had told her when I was 4 years old that I couldn't go to the bathroom to brush my teeth as she had requested me to because, and I made up this lie, that there was a ghost in there. And she said, a ghost, you know. And I think a lot of traditional American mothers would have said, you know, let's go in the bathroom and let's go see and then convince the child there was nothing to be scared of in there. My mother took my hand and she took me to the bathroom and she turned on the light and she said in this wondrous voice, where are they? And she was so hopeful that we would actually see the ghost. She was always hoping she would see the ghost of her mother in particular. And I think at times she almost thought that I was her mother reincarnated because maybe I would say something or I had a food preference and she would remember that that was very much like her mother.
Well, after a while, didn't she also come to believe that the ghost of her mother inhabited your computer?
Well, inhabited my computer. And as onset to that, she believed that I could talk to my father, my brother, her mother through the Ouija board, which, if you think about it, it's sort of a very low-tech keyboard, you know, to the Nirvana Wide Web. When I wrote my stories, my very first one, The Joy Luck Club, I had something pinned to my or taped to my computer, and it was really to remind me that I should think of the forces of the muse, and it said, call your guardian angel. And my mother used to take that literally, that what I would do is summon up these ghosts who would then help me write. And she walked up to the computer one day, and she said very coyly and kind of in a very shy little girl voice, she said, hello, are you there? Do you miss me? And she thought she was talking to her mother. She believed that these stories that I was writing had come from her mother. And the proof to her was that I wrote about things I could not possibly know.
Well, and in fact, in the Joy Luck Club, one of the stories you tell turned out to be a family secret, and you hadn't known it, and yet here you revealed it. I mean, so how do you explain that?
I don't know exactly. The story that I put in the Joy Luck Club had to do with my grandmother. Now, my mother had always told me that my grandmother had been widowed when my mother was about 2 years old, and she never was supposed to marry, but eventually she did, and that was not proper, but at least she married a very rich man and became his first wife. Later on, she accidentally died while taking too much opium. She was just enjoying herself a little too much. And well, the way I changed it, you know, I just couldn't believe that a woman would accidentally die, and there just seemed to be something going on, and my mother always lamenting that she didn't have the guidance of her mother, and it was such a traumatic thing to her. And I imagined the story differently. I made her a widow, and that later she met a man, and that the man actually raped her, and that she became pregnant as a result of that rape, and she joined the household not as the first wife, but as the fourth wife. And after the baby was born, she killed herself. And that turned out to be exactly the way that it happened. And it caused my mother to say, you know, how could you know these things?
It's funny because you've had an unusual number of uncanny experiences in your life. I mean, more than many people have. And some of them have shaped you in very lasting ways. When I'm thinking about the essay in which you trace your decision to become a writer to the really traumatic death of a roommate and the things that, the unexplainable things that happened after his death.
Right. That was probably one of the most life-changing experiences. We're all shaped by people who've died. But that one was a strange one in that he had told me a fear he had, a dream he had the week before, that two men came and strangled him, and he didn't know who they were, and that it was painful, but then it was over, and he was fine, he would be fine, and if anything happened to him, could I take care of his possessions and explain things to his parents? And I said, God, you're so morbid. What, you know, I don't know what's going on. Well, he moved out. He was scheduled to move into an apartment closer to school, and we came and stayed that first night, and the next night, two men broke into his apartment, and they tied him up, and they tortured him, and he strangled to death. It was horrendous, and we didn't understand this. I also imagined the names of the people who had killed him, and Ronald and John, and that turned out to be exactly the names of the people who were later arrested and convicted. And I began to have a number of dreams that, whether or not they were just the desire for me to make sense of what had happened, they became the dreams that changed me.
You also describe conversations you had or things you felt Pete was telling you.
I did, you know, and I look back and say, well, was it wishful thinking? And yet, one of the things that he said was, I was obsessing one day, I remember, because my cat had broken her leg and that was going to be a $350 vet bill to set it. And we didn't have that kind of money. We were very poor students. And I heard Pete kind of laugh and say, you shouldn't worry about things that you have no control over. And he said, these things take care of themselves. And he said, and I can prove it. And he was about to tell me, I thought, and then suddenly the car just went bam, and I started to weave across the road. Somebody had hit me, and I was just scared out of my mind, but I was able to pull over, and a man came out, and he said, I'm so sorry. I don't know how this happened. And he said, let's see what the, are you okay? Let's see what the damage is. I couldn't find the damage except, oh, yes, you know, a little scratch underneath the bus, this old VW bus. And he said, I'll pay for this. And I said, oh, it's not worth it to even report it to insurance. They'll just raise my rates. And he said, no, I'll pay cash. Just take it to a garage, get an estimate. Just one is fine. Mail it to me. I'll mail you the cash. Well, I went to get the estimate, got off the freeway, went to the closest garage, and the estimate was the exact same cost of the vet bill. Now, how do you explain something like that?
I don't know.
And I could hear him laughing. Well, you could say, of course, this complete coincidence that I wanted to, that I look back in retrospect and imagined it was, I don't know. I can't explain it because I actually had the vet bill and I had the estimate. And yes, indeed, he did send me the money, no questions asked. I don't know how you explain those things. But this is when I feel like there are these mysteries that happen and they just make you smile and you will never understand them. But there's good in them, and I like to believe there's good in the world that we just can't explain.
To go back to your title, The Opposite of Fate, I was thinking that the opposite is chance. I mean, fate implies that there's some hidden director shaping your life, and chance suggests that it's all random, and the only direction in life comes from just how we use our own free will to respond to the randomness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that what you meant, or do you now have another idea about what the opposite of fate would be?
I think the opposite of fate is what I learned my mother had all along, which was not just to believe in fate, but its opposite, which is hope. And in hope, all things are possible. It is not to say that hope is this form of passivity where you're just sitting in a corner crying and saying, I don't know what's going to happen, but I just hope it works out. Hope is the most powerful thing there is. It's the adrenaline of the soul. You can do anything at that moment if you hope enough. You will find the cure. You will find a way to undo it. It's not that you can, you know, change everything completely, but it is such a force of your will, of your determination. And it almost, not that it doesn't matter completely what happens, but that is the opposite of fate, to try and undo that fate, to not just sit there and say, this is the way the world is.
Amy Tan is the author of the novels The Bonesetter's Daughter and The Joy Luck Club. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps about her memoir called The Opposite of Fate.
They sat together in the park as the evening sky grew dark. She looked at him and he felt a spark tingle to his bones. 'Twas then he felt alone and wished that he'd gone straight and watched out for a simple twist of fate.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on fate. Why don't you send us an email through our website? It's at www.ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for By Chance, program number 12A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Charles Monroe Kane, with engineering help from Marv Nunn and Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.